Grant on the line. This is the commentary.ca. Long John Baldry is considered by many as the driving force of the British blues explosion of the 1960s. Scores of musicians from the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, Rod Stewart, and Elton John have been influenced by Baldry, with Stewart and John having credited Baldry for helping launch their careers. Baldry, who died in Vancouver in 1995, is the subject of a new book, It Ain't Easy, Long John Baldry and the Birth of the British Blues. The book's author, Paul Myers, himself an accomplished musician and songwriter, joins me now. He's a journalist and broadcaster who previously wrote Bare Naked Ladies, Public Stunts, Private Stories. And he used to live here in Vancouver, but now lives in Berkeley. The book published by Greystone retails for $24.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Paul Myers. Good morning, Mr. Myers.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us. Had you ever met John Baldry?
Funny thing about that, I had seen him walking down the street, and I was working on a Vancouver show called Urban Rush as a movie reviewer, and he was the musical guest one day, and I came very close to meeting him, but never did. He was about 10 feet away from me, and I didn't want to interrupt him because he was talking about something else, and he had a technical thing with his guitar that he was plugging in, and I waited, and then I thought, you know, I'll let him go now, and I'll see him later, because I lived in Vancouver, he lived in Vancouver, and I thought, I'm sure I'll run into him again, and I never did.
Were you a fan of his?
Well, let's just say I wasn't not a fan.
Right.
I was not a very active. I knew him and I respected. I knew his music and I knew who he was, but I didn't really know his music, and it wasn't really something that I knew much about. Which actually kind of makes me more qualified to write this book, because I didn't approach it from the point of view of somebody who had a. I didn't have a story to tell. I wanted to find the story and tell it. You know.
And how did you come to this idea that you would write this book?
Well, you know, happenstance, as most things in my life seem to be. I've done a lot of different jobs, and a lot of things come to me, and the question is whether I say yes to them and see where they take me. I pitched a music book idea to Rob Sanders at Greystone Books, and I said, you know, here's my story. It was some kind of pop culture thing that I probably will eventually write, so I'm not going to go into it here, but I basically pitched it to him, and I saw him glazing over, and I thought, am I that boring? Is it a bad pitch? And he said, no, it's just that I've been meaning to ask you, what do you know about Long John Baldry, because maybe you want to write his story, because, you know, from Rob's point of view, it was a Vancouver story, and he's a Vancouver publisher, and I said, well, you know, it's more than that, eh? It's like a pretty international story, and from the top of my head, I named about three things, including the fact that Baldry had discovered Rod Stewart on a train station platform, and that he had been the inspiration for Elton John to change his name to Elton, and the John part being John Baldry, and Elton Dean was the other person. But and also, I told him that, you know, he'd made this album called It Ain't Easy that had the song Don't Try to Lay No Boogie Woogie on the King of Rock and Roll that had gotten a lot of airplay in North America years ago. And I knew he knew the Stones and all this stuff. And so Rob thinks, wow, you know more about it than most people. Oh, I don't know if that wasn't true at the time. And then I went home and Googled it, you know, another victory for the Google.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home and Googled Baldry for the weekend, and I sort of made a fact sheet. And then I said to Rob on Monday, I said, you know what? I think as a musician, because I'm a musician, and I grew up listening to the Stones and the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and stuff like that, I'd always wondered about the scene in which all that stuff happened, and I had discovered over the weekend that Baldry was a prime instigator, if not a direct father of those things. He was sort of a co-father, if you will, with two other people, and I thought, this would be a good chance for me. This is what I can bring to it, my passion, and I'll find out about Baldry, and I'll find out about this mysterious enigma, if you will, and of a 6'7" white gay Englishman who happened to be the father of the British blues. So that was enough for me to get going, and then I said, sure, let's do it. And I spent 2 years doing it.
And do you find that people do recognize him as a prime instigator, as a pioneer, if you will, in the blues business in Britain, certainly?
It's people who know the real story know his role in it. Like Andrew Lou Goldham, who managed the Rolling Stones, he said that he and the Stones all knew about Baldry, and they all never forgot it. Rod never forgot it. Elton's never forgotten it. But sometimes people don't remember him, and they don't realize who he was, especially people who knew him in Toronto and in Vancouver, who knew him as the rock star next door, who they'd heard that he had a storied past, but they didn't quite know the story. And so, in a weird way, I've done them a service, I hope, because they now they know the story of the man that they just saw at the market. You know, they realize that there was a way bigger story there. So I think, and the best thing, I just want to say, Joseph, the best thing is John Mayall, who's a influential British white guy who played the blues, he is often mentioned by a lot of people in rock books as being the white guy who started it with his bands, and the John Mayall band, of course, had Eric Clapton in it and stuff like that. So what people often say is John Mayall, and I keep finding out that Baldry did it first, so I thought I better go ask John Mayall what he thinks, and it's actually kind of cool. Because I got John Mayall on the record saying, no, it was Baldry first. So in a weird kind of, if you were building a case like a lawyer, mm-hmm. I had the expert witness come in and say, no, it was Baldry. He's the one who done it. You know, so it was good. It was just fun for me as a musician and as a journalist to combine all the things that I really dig. You know, I sort of dug the forensic science part of it, you know.
Why isn't it, though, that he's not recognized as or widely known as he should be?
A lot of things happen because of bad management, or I wonder if Baldry, this is where I can only speculate, I wonder if Baldry had less of a killer instinct than some people. He was humble and kind to a lot of people, and I think there's a certain part of self-mythology that he probably didn't master. And I think at the end of the day, he probably didn't have that thing that burns inside people to sort of say, check me out. I think he was happy when things came his way, and he certainly seized on several opportunities in his life. And maybe he didn't have enough confidence. He wasn't, to be honest, he wasn't the most tuneful singer. So, you know, when he had hit records or popular records, they were always based on the character of his voice and the nature of the music and the sort of personality of it. And so he wasn't somebody who could, that's not to say he was a terrible singer, but his singing voice was not, it was gravelly, and he strained sometimes in the higher registers, especially towards the end. I mean, he smoked too much, and he drank too much, and so, you can pick out any number of reasons from those.
How did he get the nickname Long John Baldry?
Strangely enough, his sister told me it was from the hospital where he was born. He was the longest baby ever born in that hospital. I mean, again, we have no way of verifying these records. I'm not going to claim that I've checked the hospital records against what people say. But he was 27 inches at birth, which apparently is quite a record for the East Haddon Hospital. And apparently a nurse said, we got a Long John here. I take it that that's stuck, and then I think people called him that in high school, the way people would have called him Stretch, something like that. Although the strange thing is his family, the males on his side of the family were all police officers. His brother's a police officer, and his father's, so there must have been a lot of tall genes in the family. So, but they called him Long John.
When you saw him at Shaw, did it strike you as tall?
Yes, although, I will say this, he'd had osteoporosis and a hip replacement. By the time I saw him, he was well into his 60s. And he did hunch, and he did walk with a cane, which is so, I think the reason as I recall now, I didn't approach him is that it seemed to take him a long time to walk to the door. It seemed to be like, it looked painful. Maybe he had gout, too, which it means your feet swell up, amongst other things. And I think that the hunch kind of took away from some of his height, but definitely he wore fedoras too, and the fedoras are usually pretty tall hats anyway, so yeah, you could tell it was a tall guy. You could just tell.
How did he end up in Vancouver?
Well, ultimately that would be the story of the book in a weird way. He like so many British people of a certain era, he was fascinated with America but didn't really want to be an American. At the end of the day, there's that British sort of ethnicity that seemed to have settled out towards Victoria and Vancouver, and he sort of worked his way across the country, having first settled, he was going to be in New York, and then he had a record deal in Toronto, so he ended up in Toronto there, but didn't like the icy winters, especially when you're that tall. If you fall off your feet when you're 6'7", it's a long way down.
Right.
So he just didn't like the chilly, ice-cold winters. I'm from Toronto, I know exactly what he's talking about, and same reason I ended up in Vancouver, actually. It's like being in, you get to be in Canada, you get to be in a media center, and you have a perch to work the, West Coast market, but you get to be in Vancouver, which is, such a nice place. So I think he just really loved it, and he lived in Kitsilano, so he had a very, it's a very enticing view he had of the North Shore, you know. So.
And then how long had he lived here before he died, I guess, 3 years ago?
He died in July 2005, so just over 2 years ago. And he lived here for about 20 years. He lived exactly 20 years, actually. He moved in 84, 85, so.
And you'd lived here in Vancouver.
Yes.
He was pretty much a part, I mean, we used to hear about him all the time. He would be on television or we'd read about him in columns and so on. He appeared places.
Yes. I think I saw him, his name on benefit posters and, you know, animal rescue mission things. And because he was a very socially concerned person. Probably because he'd had some oppression in his own life. I mean, in England it was illegal to be a homosexual until 1968. So he was sort of half out of the closet, but he didn't really, you know, it was his prerogative to not advertise the fact. I mean, and I totally understand that. You know, he didn't want to be a poster boy. But he was very socially conscious, and I think he did a lot of, he actually lost a guitar once in 1960 in London. He was protesting the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa. And he was in London, and so he was outside the South African consulate, and he had a very expensive guitar case with him, you know, the guitar inside it, and he left it on the street because he was so distracted shouting, you know, smash apartheid, end apartheid. And I always thought that was a good example of a lot of things in his life. He was very much in the moment, distracted by things that were in front of him, so didn't go long range. Like, if that had been me, I can honestly tell you I would have found a place to hide the guitar or give the guitar to someone or just never let go of it and still yelled against apartheid. But I feel like, you know, I feel like it's a great example of him. So the reason I mention that is that in Vancouver, I noticed he was always showing up at cancer benefits and various other things. And, you know, he brought Tom Jones in, too, for a few things. And he, you know, he always managed to sort of use the connections he had to help causes and stuff like that, so he was happy to play that role.
I'm going to mention three artists, one group and two artists, and then and you'll tell me their connection to Baldry and how they influenced him and how he influenced them, pardon me. The Beatles. You talked to Paul McCartney for this book.
Yes.
What did he say about Long John Baldry and his effect on his career?
Well, first he remembers him as a gentleman who he loved. Like the Beatles all looked, they sort of looked up to him. You know, they're not that much younger than him, but Mike McCartney told me as well, to verify this, that the internet wasn't around, and the only way to get music, you know, going was by word of mouth along British Rail. He sort of said the British Rail was like the internet of its day, and you literally brought the albums up from London, and the Beatles got stuff in through Liverpool, through the port, and they would trade. And so, very instrumental. One of the things that I learned was that John Lennon, the harmonica solo at the front of Love Me Do was directly inspired by the style of Little Walter, the blues artist, who John Baldry had lent him a record of. So that's a very physical example of the influence. And then the other thing that Paul McCartney said, you know, besides him being a gentleman that they admired, they looked up to him as a guy who really understood the music that they were just discovering. And then when they got famous, like, they knew him in 62, but then when they got really famous in 64, they had a TV special, and they brought some of their friends on that they admired, and they had Baldry sing I've Got My Mojo Working on that show, and almost everyone in Britain saw Baldry for the first time who hadn't seen him already. And if you see the clip ever, the Beatles are off to the side of the stage cheering him on and applauding on, you know, and clapping on beat and stuff, and it's a very clear, they wanted the world to know this was their friend John, you know. So that's something I didn't realize. John Baldry was, like, you know, a huge influence on them.
You mentioned Elton John and changing his name. How did they meet Elton John and John Baldry?
Well, by this point, when Elton met, Elton was Reggie Dwight, and he was a touring keyboard player in a band called Bluesology that was actually a show band that, you know, played covers of American blues songs, and every so often they would back American blues artists who were touring in the UK. Baldry had a reputation already as having been a blues kind of, you know, very popular blues artist, and he had also been in a band called Steam Packet at this point, and Steam Packet were like a very popular band with Rod Stewart, Julie Driscoll, and Brian Auger, and John Baldry, so it was like a everyone in that band had a separate career, but then they formed this super group. It was actually the first super group. So Elton John had seen them and was very, you know, very aware of them. That band broke up, and then about a little while later, there was auditions, basically, for bands, and then John Baldry decided that instead of getting separate players, he would just take Bluesology. So he subsumed them into his band. So suddenly, Bluesology was the Long John Baldry Review. So Reggie Dwight was obviously playing keyboards in that band, and that got him on the big circuit, and it was a big break for Bluesology to become Baldry's backup band. And then as it wore on him, they were playing this hit that he'd had in England called Let the Heartaches Begin, which was kind of a, you know, what I consider like an Engelbert Humperdinck kind of housewives kind of ballad, you know, nice song, but it wasn't rootsy, it wasn't anything. And they started playing this song with a backing tape of the string section from the recording, and Elton was just getting, or at this point Reggie was getting just tired of like this trotting out this song and playing to working men's clubs where they were being hostile, and he really was itching to get his solo career going. So with John Baldry's blessing, he said, "I'm leaving, and Bernie Taupin and I are going to go off and try and be a songwriting team." And there was a saxophone player in the Bluesology named Elton Dean. And so he decided that he liked the name Elton a lot, and he liked the name John, and he wanted to sort of pay tribute to the John Baldry influence, so it became Elton John.
Rod Stewart, you have a number of photos, a couple of photos in the book. They seem to have a very close relationship.
You know, I would say it was like a father-son relationship. Again, though, the Baldry wasn't that much older than Rod, but he was just old enough, and he'd been playing a lot longer than Rod, that he became his parental mentor, and they both swear they never had a sexual relationship, but they definitely had a deep love for each other as brothers, and whenever Baldry, you know, I think Rod always remembered that he wouldn't have had a career except for Baldry discovering him on a train station platform, which helpfully Rod Stewart referred to it as being like on American Idol in 1964. Like, if there had been an American Idol in England in 1964, that would have been the feeling of being discovered by John Baldry to be in his band, and then being allowed to shine in that band. So when Rod became a huge star, several times through his career, he paid back whenever John needed a break or an album to be produced, he produced two albums for he co-produced with Elton John, It Ain't Easy, the album, and another album called Everything Stops for Tea, and then various, you know, financial debts. Whenever John Baldry needed anything, Rod was generally there for it. If he wasn't there in person, he was on the phone. And to this day, when he granted me the interview, he said, "I'll do anything to help you talk about John Baldry." You know, and it was a hard interview to get, because to get through the people that Rod Stewart has around him, it was like, you know, one of those things where when you finally get to the guy himself, he goes, "I'm glad I'm talking to you," and I'm like, "I'm glad you're talking to me too, but like you wouldn't have known it talking to all the layers of people around him."
I know the feeling.
Yeah. Well, luckily I'm easy to get.
you mentioned getting to Rod Stewart and just his willingness to talk about John Baldry. Was that much the same with the other people you talked to? I mean, you talked to Elton John, you talked to Paul McCartney, you talked to many others.
Yeah, well, I mean, I talked to people that people don't know that I discovered were important to the story. Like, if you're a Yardbirds or Rolling Stones fan, you may have heard of Giorgio Gomelsky, the European emigrant in London who was a very big figure in the early 60s scene, and very much a combination of a PR person and a nightclub promoter and record label guy, and talking to Giorgio Gomelsky was just great, and talking to Chris Barber, who I'd never heard of before, frankly. He was a trad jazz star, the trad jazz scene, which was much more like Dixieland. He was the guy who, you know, brought Muddy Waters over, he's one of the key guys to bring Muddy Waters over, and John Baldry was singing in Chris Barber's band and made sure that he got people to turn out for Muddy Waters, and then they got to know Willie Dixon, and so talking to Chris Barber was great. Like, people, you know that expression, like, it put me in the room, you know, like when you're a forensic scientist or, placing people at the scene of the crime, if you will, and to have key witnesses from all of those steps, Tony McCauley, who wrote the number one hit song that I referred to earlier, I talked to him at length about, you know, the whole move to get John Baldry on Top of the Pops, which was the big career-making show in Britain. And I talked to the woman who was Tony McCauley's girlfriend at the time, who later became his Baldry's Canadian publicist. Like, she moved from London to Toronto to work with John Baldry and got him his Canadian record deal, which resulted in three albums for EMI. So to get all the, and I got the EMI label boss who signed him in 1980. You know, and I got Brian Auger. I talked to Billy Gaff, who was managing Rod and the Faces, but also took on John Baldry and got him signed to Warner Brothers for the It Ain't Easy album. So, you know, everybody I needed to get, except for like two or three people, and of course you always remember the ones that got away, like the Rolling Stones I came very close to getting, but their publicist, again, like so many publicists, was always deferring me. And then it looked like there'd be a window, and then Keith Richards fell out of a tree.
I remember, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So thanks to the coconut. You know, thanks to the coconut, I didn't get Keith on the record. But I managed to find other sources for those. Luckily, they have spoken about Baldry before. And I also was very close to getting Jimmy Page, but he had gone on an extended vacation in, like, to somewhere in the Middle East or something. I think Africa, actually, West Africa. And it was one of the things where they didn't know when he'd be back, and he's not in the custom of telling people when he's coming back, and I had a deadline, so...
At the end of his life, did he know how beloved he was as an artist and how influential he was?
I don't know if... I can't speak from a, you know, like a definitive statement he ever made, but many people of the rock intelligentsia, or the rock, whatever you call it, the rock aristocracy, or I guess they call it arorocracy, I don't know. He had definitely had a VIP pass to anything. You know, if anyone from that, what they call the rock era, like the Moody Blues, there's a photograph of them in my book where, you know, when he lived in Toronto, the Moody Blues were coming through to play Maple Leaf Gardens, and, of course, Baldry's backstage, you know, and they're excited that he's come to see them. And, you know, so that there must have been this weird thing for people who didn't know who Baldry was, that suddenly they're letting in this tall Englishman who they'd never heard of, other people had never heard of, and then, you know, there's all these rock stars fawning over him. So, I think he knew that people, and as a person, everyone who knew him, and I kind of wish I had met him, everyone who knew him talks about how he always made you feel very loved. He was a charmer. He really cared about making people happy and letting others shine, which is another reason why he probably never made it as big as those people. He probably was very good at deferring the attention to them. So, you know, from everything I've read, he might have had moments where he wished things had gone a different way, but I think he knew that he'd made a difference. Everyone speaks of that. That he just had a good social life anyway, and probably didn't make as much money as a lot of people.
The reaction to the book has been what?
Oh, so far it's been great. I actually hoped that people would either connect to the story from a historical point of view, or people who knew him would say, "Oh, that's cool." But people who knew him have actually been twice as good about it. Andrew Lou Golden, who I was referring to before from the Rolling Stones management, he was there, and he says to me that I tapped the source and revealed the, you know, I think the phrase he used was the truth about the passionate, undisciplined, caring, and often crazed world of our beloved John. Now, I'm quoting that on purpose because the fact that he said that, I didn't know John Baldry the way he knew him, and he says I got it, so that's cool. And the family have said that they really appreciate that I managed to present it in a true light. Because I didn't set out to write a puff piece, and I didn't set out to write a destroying piece either. I set out to tell a story that there's going to be moments where maybe he did drink too much, and maybe he did smoke too much, and maybe he did, make a bad decision that he made for the wrong reasons. But the truth is, he also did a lot of great things and a lot of good things, and made some records that weren't that good, and made some records that were amazing. So, Elton John actually said to me, by the way, he always felt that John Baldry never made that record that showed what he was like in a concert situation. He didn't mean necessarily a live album, but he just never translated the thing that was charismatic about him, never got onto any one record. So I always figure now, if he'd met Ry Cooder, maybe they could have made a really swampy record in Memphis or something, you know?
Now, you live in Berkeley now.
Yeah.
We used to see you around town all the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I sat behind you once in a movie screening.
I hope I didn't talk to you.
No, you were fine. What are you doing in Berkeley now? Are you working on another book?
Yeah, Yeah, well, I moved because my wife has a great job with Chronicle Books, and I'm freelancing, so I can pretty much work anywhere, and I have a green card application that's knock wood, it's going well. And I've been freelancing. I did a project that I will talk about when it's come out. I sort of ghost wrote a book that it was lucrative, and it managed to be my only gig in the last little while, and it's good. But I'm also about to do another book, and I'm looking forward to getting into broadcasting again, because I did a lot of broadcasting in Vancouver, and there's an opportunity that I'm waiting to hear about that I can't talk about because I would jinx it.
Congratulations on this book, because it's obviously you had great fun doing it, and
yeah.
you're having great fun talking about it.
Oh, I am, yeah.
And continued good luck with it, Paul, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
The book is called It Ain't Easy, Long John Baldry and the Birth of the British Blues, $24.95 from Greystone. I'm Joseph Plata.